Okay, so where were we? Yeah, so my position was that the technology to support direct focus communication is fine. We know all about it. Staying in touch, peripheral awareness is not addressed well by procurement technologies, and media spaces were trying to support this notion of awareness and peripheral awareness and how people can stay in touch. What we found, this is a project that we did from 2002 to 2005, if I recall correctly. We had the notion that if we got outside of the work environment and look at people communications with their friends and family, maybe there was room for new technologies for communication, for mediated communication. And of course, since we did this work, social networks have arrived, and social networks are used a lot for these intimate social networks, meaning the networks of your close friends and family, although this is not at all what they've been designed for. So if they're used in this way, it's sort of an adaptation of their use. So the Interliving project, that was around 2001, 2003, lasts for 3 years. And we decided to study communication among distributed families. Families who usually they haven't decided so, but through the sort of history of their lives have ended up being distributed in different places in the same country, sometimes across countries. And so we worked with over 70 family members in France, in the US, and Sweden, that was the partners of the projects. From different ages, from the kids to the grandparents, which was very complicated to explain to our funders. It's like, why do you need to pay travel tickets for entire families? What is this project about exactly? At the time, we were also paying for internet subscriptions for these families, so they would have high-speed internet access. It's like, how do you justify that you're paying for someone's internet connection? Anyway, quite a set of unexpected challenges. So we applied the participatory design approach that you've seen in bootcamp, in a sense, but with this population of users. And we created, now the thing is when you know, traditionally, when you work with professional users of technology, it's okay to go into the workplace if they agree with you on the project, to work with them, to spend time with them, to develop the technology, then to put it in their offices, and then to see how they use it. When you develop technologies for families, it's going to be more difficult. When you tell them, well, are you going to build this system? It has a camera, it's a microphone, are you going to put it in your living room? you need to explain what you're doing. So what we created is something that we call technology probes. The notion of a probe here is we did not want to create a finished product. We didn't want to create something where we had the solutions and then they were going to tell us we like it or we're not. We wanted something unfinished so we would see how they would appropriate it. And that would be a base to iterate the design. So unfinished prototypes with as few functions as possible and designed to understand their needs rather than to solve it, which means solving it somewhat partially to see if it goes in the right direction, what's missing, etc. And we had three goals. One is to sort of feed the design process. So to inspire both users about, oh, what could I do with this if it had also this other capability, and also to us to see how they use it and maybe have ideas. Test the technology in situ in the people's homes and collect usage data so we could see what people were actually doing with it. Although we have protocols so that before they sent us any data, they were able to review it and to decide what they wanted to send us or not. And the data was kept on our sites, and if you wanted to publish even an image in an article, we had to have their authorization. So we created multiple probes. So I don't know why this image is like that, but there was one which was a message probe, which is close to what you showed me, this kind of or the other tool, the post-it notes, but they were shared among family members. So we had this touch display, which were in two homes, and you could create a post-it and write on the post-it note, and it would be reflected on the distant screen, and so people could exchange messages in this way. Then there's the video probe I'm going to talk about. There was one that was called the Talk Talk, which was about sound, and the last one was a little puppet theater for using tangible interfaces for kids. So I'm going to focus on the one that has to do with video communication. So this was the video probe. Stéphane Conversi was one of my students at the time. And the idea was to have a device in your home that we work with the industrial designers to create something that did not look like you had a computer sitting in your living home, in your living room. So we created this device based on an iMac, I believe, that had a camera, a very simple remote, and its purpose in life was to take pictures. But not like a regular camera where it takes a picture when you push the button. It would take pictures when it felt like taking a picture. Now, it used motion sensing. So the thing is that if nothing is happening, there's no need to take a picture. If something moves in front of the camera, something interesting may be happening. So we wait until this motion stops, meaning maybe you're staring at the device. And if it's and if it becomes well, not completely steady, but if motion almost stops for 2 to 3 seconds, then the system shows you that it's about to take a picture. It's kind of a frame thing that grows, and then it takes the picture. And then this picture is shared with another device that you decide to pair this one with. So, you know, with a close friend or family. So, and then those pictures are displayed on the other side. The little remote allows you to browse those images, and these images disappear after a few days. So the goal is to just have kind of what we call the day in the life of the remote person that you can browse when you get home, see what happened on the other side. Now, we also put a feature which allowed you to keep an image that you wanted to keep. The other ones, in fact, they wouldn't disappear abruptly. They would fade out. So they would turn from color to less color to black and white to fading out, and then they would go away. So people would know, and if they wanted to keep it, it would get back its colors. So what we found is we put that in the homes of several families. One family was two Italian cousins. And you know, Italian cousins, they talk a lot to each other. So. another installation were two sisters who were both students, but in different places around Paris. And what we found is people use this in ways we didn't anticipate, which was exactly what we were looking for. Is what would you do with this? So there is the kind of explicit use. Now this thing is only sending pictures. So here it's showing the map of Paris and it's saying demain, tomorrow, and it's showing that I can't recognize who it is, say to his cousin, saying, well, if you want to go to Paris tomorrow. So they use it to exchange messages in this way. This was someone feeding their kid. The camera is far enough away that it's actually, the motion sensing is quite primitive. So it was taking more as regular snapshots because there is a bit of motion and then things more or less stop. So it's enough to trigger the picture taking, etc. And so at the end of this, there's kind of a series of a picture that, you know, shows you the dad feeding his kid. This one was installed in a very small apartment in the kitchen, and you can see the person go around, etc. So what was interesting, and I'll show you example videos as well. So the families loved it. And you know they love it when you, the day you come to take it away from them. They say, no, please. They really love this idea of implicit sharing of everyday life that would let you not miss events that have happened that you would otherwise have missed. They created the, you know, these little albums of pictures they wanted to take. They would browse the thing in the evening to see what had happened. And in fact, it became sort of part of the everyday routine. It made families closer. They were better aware of other family members, and interestingly, it increased their number of phone calls to each other. And part of this is because the pictures gave them an idea of what had happened, so ideas of what to talk about to the other, or reasons to talk to the other, but also gave them information about whether the others are home or available or etc. And they told us really before, they call each other a lot, but you always have the sense that you may come at a bad time or something. And with that, they felt much less so. Having said that, deploying this thing was, at the time, the technology was not very reliable, so we had all sorts of problems. The calibration of this motion thing was pretty tricky, so it sometimes would take lots of pictures just because there were clouds in the sky and the thing would go, you know, less light, more light, and would take useless pictures. But there was a case where they had a Christmas dinner and they didn't pay attention to the device, and the device took pictures all evening, and then they have this great recording of their Christmas. So that was about sharing still pictures. And the term video probe is probably not well chosen because it's really for photos. So then we wanted to try something else, which was to create a kind of holding space, but on a more personal scale. So that people who know each other well, could be a couple who's separated physically because they have to live in different places for whatever reason, or close friends or whatever. And so we had the idea of creating a device that we call the mirror space, where if you're the, again, the idea of two devices in two different places, in the homes of two people, so they are paired. And if someone goes in front of one of these and there's nobody on the other side, it acts as a mirror, it just shows your own image. If someone approaches the mirror on the other side at the same time, then the two images are superimposed. And we did experiments among ourselves that when you put images of two people on top of each other, it creates a sense of intimacy. If it's a person you don't know, you're gonna step back, it's like, whoa. And so we found this was, you know, interesting to create a technology that creates a sense of proximity and intimacy, even though you are at a distance. So the way we did this is that we embedded the camera at the very middle of the screen. It was so funny because the camera is really literally in the middle of the screen, and yet in experiments we ran, people were asking, but where is the camera? I can't see it. It's right there. And there was a proximity sensor, because what happened, and it's sort of illustrated here, is that if the person is far away, we blur the image. And as you get closer, the image gets sharper. And the idea with this is to recreate the notion of social distance. You know, you don't act the same when the person is in the corridor at the other end and when you are 2 meters away. Now, because here the range was much more compressed, and you don't get as good a sense of distance on the video image, we did this blurriness, which also meant that if someone was moving in front of the mirror at the distance, you see a blurry shape. And in fact, people who know each other as well will recognize each other. And if you don't know the person, well, it's kind of a shape going in front of the screen. So, yeah, this is all explained here. So then we proceeded to deploy this. Now, the problem is, at the time, the type of network connection that people could have at home was not good enough to have real-time video back and forth the way we have today. So we could not, unfortunately, deploy it in people's homes, but we deployed it in several installations and exhibits. So there are three of them. The last one was in the Pompidou Center, where they had an exhibit on design. And so here what they did is they built this fake wall, and they put one device on each side. And it was right at the entrance of the exhibit. And so there was a little explanation of what it was on the side, although I never saw anybody reading it. And so people approached it from each side. And usually it was one group of person goes on one side, another group of visitors go on to the other side, they approach, and then they merge their images like, whoa, who is that? And then they realize that there's people on the other side, and then the people of the same group who know each other as well said, oh, why don't you go on the other side? And then they start playing with their merged image. So to us, it provided enough evidence that, you know, it was an interesting communication device. And that it really created this, this sense of intimacy. There's a video I hope it's going to show that is really, really interesting about that. So what we learned from that is, you know, we have a tendency to want to create technology that replicates the physical world. I'm not a big fan of VR, for example, because I think it tries too hard to make things real, knowing that there are technological limitations. I think that what is more interesting is to take technology and use it for what it's best at, and make things that are impossible in real life. So there's a famous article by Jim Holland that's called Beyond Being There. You know, if we cannot make a technology that will give us the sense of being there, can we do things that go beyond that? And I think there's a vast unexplored space in that area. And this mirror space thing, it's just a very simple, I mean, you know, the technology there is not very sophisticated, and you could do a lot more interesting things. Especially now you have a real-time face tracking in all your smartphones. So yeah, you can put yourself a Mickey Mouse head, but I think we can do things that are more interesting. And I think what we came up with was this notion of multi-scale communication. It's the idea that we are very used to social protocols to engage in communication. Just, you know, approaching someone and deciding to look at the person to say, I would like to talk to you, versus, you know, pretending you're looking at something else because you want to avoid the person, or speeding up the pace to show that you're in a hurry, even maybe you're not in a hurry. We play with that constantly. We don't even think about it, right? When we go online, all these things become impossible, or people invent their own protocols. But there is this notion that you approach, you send signals to about the type of communication you would like to have. Then the other person will reciprocate the signals or not. Then you decide to engage in the conversation. And there is also this protocol, you know, showing, well, I would like to go now. Can we end this? Now, what I find really annoying in the means of communications we have today is that we have different modes of communication, and to transition to one from one to the other is super heavy. So, you know, if you want to, you start typing email, but maybe the other person is online. So why can't this become a chat? And you start texting, and then why cannot this be turned into a video call and then go back to a text chat? So currently, you have to shift literally from one system to the next. I mean, I'm sure there are counterexamples, but it's not an accepted thing that you should support multiple modes of communication inside the same, say, application. So multi-scale communication is the idea of supporting this notion of transition from peripheral awareness, you know, sharing a view of my office just so people know if I'm here or not, to the very focused one-to-one communication over a video call, or maybe in a different context, the mirror space I just described. And the idea that this transition should be fluid, that you don't have to operate a complex interface to transition from one to the next. And so again, I think that there's space in this area to invent new new system and new ways to integrate these things together. Now, one thing that has been starting to get more and more common these days was the idea to embody yourself in a remote robot to do, for example, teleworking. So this is from a company called Willow Garage from Silicon Valley. I don't know if they still exist, but they manufacture these robots. And so if you don't go to work, you can actually log in and take one of these robots. And you have an image from your webcam on that. You have audio back and forth. And there's two cameras, one here that's like your eyes. And there's one down here so you can look at your immediate surroundings. So you don't bump into things. So this is the view from the downward camera. Yes?
Are they still used as of today?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
You mean you can work in the basement and all those things roaming around?
Yes.
And there's no accidents.
Well, so I think historically, I think that the need came more for people who were, for example, handicapped or couldn't or had an accident, and so were teleworking because they could not physically move. An example where it's been used quite heavily is in some conferences. So our main conference, the CHI conference, they now always have a dozen or maybe even more of these robots. And people can actually register, and they do have to pay a registration fee, less high than if you attend the conference. And then they can essentially go about the conference in this with these devices. There's room at the front, on the side of the front row for the robots who are in there. And we even had the case. So we had a student who had a paper accepted at this conference, and the conference was in the U.S. And 2 days before going to the U.S., he filled out his ESTA form, you know, the travel authorization, and the thing said, nope, you're not allowed to travel. And he was, and to this day, he doesn't know why. I mean, he's a Dutch student who was in our lab. He's, you know, he doesn't know that he's done anything weird in his life, and they refuse to give you an explanation when they say no. So the traditional thing in that case is that he would have given his slides to someone who was at the conference, who would have probably done a pretty poor job at presenting his paper. And so we said, okay, let's go crazy. Let's take one of these robots and put it on the stage. And he was in Denmark. Because he had been a student with us, but he was doing a PhD in Denmark at the time. So he was in Denmark. He used the video software. I don't know what kind of, it's not Skype, but the video software, so people would see his face and he could see the room. Then the slides were displayed on the shared screen with the WebStraits. I've told you about the web sharing. Have I told you about WebStraits?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. So he was controlling the slideshow from Denmark. And then for the audio through the robot was pretty crappy. So we had Carla, one of our students, on the cell phone, plugged into the audio system of the room. And he gave his talk remotely. Well, if you add to that, there was time difference because I think the conference was in Denver and he was in Denmark. So It's kind of late for him, but it worked. It worked amazingly well. Very stressful for us and probably for him, but it did work. So
what was he presenting?
He was presenting a paper that he had accepted at the conference, which was actually looking at what he called the ecosystem of communication apps. He was looking at how people use Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp and these different types of application. And the findings were that people segregate their circles of friends or families or, well, their social circles into different apps. And in fact, last week, one of the PhD defenses that was defended was by the same Carla who was helping on that presentation, Carla Grigio, who was actually a former student of this master's, who did a whole thesis on this issue of how people use communication apps to sort of manage their online social life. I think, you know, it would be kind of silly that if to have everybody at home and having only robots in the workplace sort of running into each other. But for some usages, why not? I actually visited this this company and tried on one of these things. It's really, you're not really there when you are sort of behind your laptop and trying to drive the thing to the door and this kind of thing. But I think it has potential. In fact, in our research, we do studies on how to support collaborative work, including remote collaborative work, when people use these large wall-sized displays. So if you share information on the display and you work with someone. And so we've done things where we used one of these robots that represents where the other person is in the other room. So you sort of get the physical awareness of where the person is. Problem is, robots move slower than the person. So, you know, the person at the remote place has gone over across the room and the robot is kind of trying to catch up while avoiding the people in the local room. So to summarize, and I'll show you a couple of videos of interliving, I can actually maybe show you also the one on the camera. Anyway, so to summarize, video communication is very powerful, and I did it with great power comes great responsibilities, in the sense that, you know, protecting people's privacy should really be a primary concern. Most people want to communicate not with the entire world, like Facebook would like you to think, but with their close family and friends, and if possible, privately. And I think, you know, the spread of social networks have been around, you know, let's have as many friends as possible. But I think there is an addressed need for this kind of what sociologists call intimate social networks. And of course, people appropriate the technology, so they do use WhatsApp and others for this type of communication, but it's not been designed for that. So it does not necessarily fulfill their needs, in particular about privacy. Communication is a process, and the telephone model is really not the right model. So it's this notion of multi-scale communication I talked about, from peripheral awareness to focus exchange back to peripheral awareness. And a lot of the current technology makes the wrong assumptions. You want the mediation to be as transparent as possible. The fact that you have to have all these IDs and these logins and all these things that you coordinate. I mean, we often work where we have a shared document on Google Docs or on Share LaTeX, combined with a chat thing somewhere, combined with a video communication. Last 2 weeks ago, we were in a conference meeting, program committee meeting, which is the part of the conference where we decide which papers get accepted and which papers get rejected, right? So usually this meeting is done face-to-face. Everybody flies to the same place, and we spend 2 days you know, discussing the papers, and some are easily accepted, some are easily rejected, and then it goes in the middle, and we don't know, so we ask someone else to read it, and then we discuss, and then we rediscuss, and then we make a final decision. And the process there is not just about deciding, is the paper in or out? You know, we could do that in much more efficient way. What's interesting is the discussions that take place. You know, why did this paper in the end get accepted or not? What was important? What do people consider, what the community of people, the peers that evaluate papers consider is an interesting topic these days, or on the contrary, you know, we've seen too many of those, so we're not interested. A paper that is rejected today, maybe the same paper would have been accepted 2 years ago. So it's all that is important. Now this year, for the first time, this conference program committee meeting was held totally online. Everybody was sitting, most people at home, some were at work, with a very good, actually, video system called Zoom. And at the same time, it worked. So we did the job. Now it was kind of a nightmare technologically, because you have a window with a Zoom thing for the video. Then you need to be able to have private conversations. So there were Slack with a zillion channels to avoid conflicts of interest, so you can discuss privately. Then there was another thing with a list of accepted papers, so we can start making sessions. There were our reviews of the paper. I mean, we were doing this with Wendy. We were at home. We had three screens plus two laptops, and it was still not enough screen space. And in a sense, it worked, but it was not really as engaging as being in person. And what was missing is, in the program committee meeting, it's everything that happens outside the meeting itself. You go out for lunch, you go out for dinner, you talk to people. And in fact, I think the most telling example, I mean, telling sign that it was, you know, not as good as people want it to be, is that the newcomers, people who attend this meeting for the first time, and you know, we need to have the newer faculty member to learn how to do this stuff, they felt really sort of left aside, in a sense. I mean, they talked when they had to talk, but they didn't participate as much as in a physical meeting. So the problem is that we have technology today that is good enough, in a sense that it works, but I think it leaves aside a number of important aspects of what makes real life communication what it is. So privacy is critical, constant shifts between levels of engagement. Sometimes, you know, we want to sort of be there, sometimes we want to sort of stay in the background. And I think we could use the capabilities of current technologies to do some of this, but it doesn't seem to be much of interest to people who create those tools. There's a set of references that will be, I suppose, on the website. So let me show you a couple of videos, crossing fingers that it will work, of interliving. Okay, that's a good start. Okay, I always like to show this video because the first shot title, yes.
Satori Design Project.
This is
with the goal of designing interactive, intergenerational interfaces for families that live together. We are working closely with 7 families, 3 in Sweden, 3 in France, and 1 in the United States. The families each include a core family with parents and children, and related households with grandparents, grown children, or siblings with their own families. We use a wide variety of methods, including interviewing family members in their homes and asking them to participate in various activities, such as drawing maps of their relationships with each other or taking pictures of favorite objects within their homes. The most important design activity involves workshops, in which we invite the family members to join us for a day of reflection and design. We begin by listening to stories from the different family members and giving them the opportunity to share information they have created, such as photographs, relationship maps, and journals. The next step is to develop these stories into scenarios that retain context and detail and are grounded in real-world experiences. Next, everyone gets to participate in generating ideas for new technologies, no matter how crazy or off the wall. We use standard brainstorming and word games, but also ask the family members to build mock-ups and explore their ideas with video cameras. The final stage is to bring the use scenarios and the technology ideas together in the form of videotape design scenarios, what we call video prototypes. Everyone participates, including children and grandparents. Some ideas are practical, such as helping mothers keep track of other members of the family. Others are more whimsical, involving lightweight ways of staying in touch with a particular loved one. We are now developing more complex prototypes based on our design work with the families and the information we have gathered from them, which will provide more effective and fun ways for distributed families to stay in touch.
So this is just to show that we practice what we preach. So, you know, none of these things would surprise you after bootcamp. Maybe they would have surprised you before bootcamp. and that's the way we work with real users here, these various families. So let me show the video probe. So which part is this? Okay, this explains how it works. So this was us testing it at home with my son and his friend. He was taking a bit too many pictures. I'm sorry?
So you already play guitar?
Not really. You don't want to hear the sound.
Oh.
Anyway, so this was the Violet family. So this is what we mean by the day in the life, is that she's there, she's having breakfast, then she's on the phone, then she's going out, then she's back. and that's the kind of thing that, you know, her friend could share at the end of the day. And as I said, she has allowed us to show this video. Now, this was the other family, the yellow family. And very different, you know, family with two kids. So here, you know, they were exchanging messages. And so they were with us reviewing the pictures and explaining what it was and what they, you know, what they were doing with the device. And well, the audio is in French, so I won't play it, but I mean, as you see, it's sitting in the living room. the segment I was going to show. So again, you know, we see this sort of everyday life images that help really people stay in touch without the overhead of saying, oh, you know, why don't you call me on Skype and all this stuff that people have to coordinate usually when you try to stay in touch with your family, say. Well, so anyway, that's. I think that's the part I just showed. Yes. Now, the one that is probably more directly relevant is when we design the mirror space. So here are little video, before the technology existed, we created these video prototypes where we were playing here with the notion of blurriness to see, you know, how, you know, you can play with it. So this is one of the designer that if you approach your hand, the system would think you would be closer and would put you in focus. If I remove the hand, I'm blurry. And the idea was to convey the sense of distance. That's the second aspect of it, which was the transparency. So we have these two people, they are in the distance, they're blurry, they approach the camera. She's there first, she says, hey, where are you? And here you see the two images getting superimposed. And so that was done in Premiere with just compositing, you know, there was nothing working. And then we created actual working prototypes. This was the first one. And you see how people are spontaneously playing with it. This was the camera in the middle, the camera that most people didn't see. Okay. Well, I guess he ended up seeing it. And you see spontaneously people play. So I have two segments that are really, that I find really cool. Is that it? Oh yeah. So this was a couple, and in exhibit there was one screen on one wall and the second one was on the other one room. And so they first approach it and they see themselves and they smile and this and that. But okay. And then he looks there and said, oh, but look, I see my image there. And again, there was no explanation exactly of what it was. And so he decides to go there. And then suddenly they they meet remotely, in a sense. And she's trying to eat his nose. And she tells him, well, go back. And then they start playing with it. And I think I have a last clip here. I can't resist. I think this was another. So there are two sisters, so their faces are really similar. Now the interesting thing with that is that it would also generalize to more than two devices. We could have three or more, and then you could make the superimposition and, as you see fit. So anyway, I think this is it for me for today. Any questions, comments, ideas for your projects? Well, okay then. So I'm going to wish you happy holidays wherever you will be. I will not see you until the very end of January. So the next two classes are by Cédric, right? And so don't forget to enter stuff in the spreadsheets. And I'll see you next year. Thank you.